All right, hello everyone. This is the introduction to Humanities 2. This is Church Fathers through the Reformation. And this is a class that is for our 7th and 8th graders at Christ Church Academy. And I'd given this introduction to them, but something happened with my recording equipment and I couldn't record it. So I'm recording it now. And there are a lot of benefits, I think, to hearing this, which is why I wanted to record it. And this is an introduction to our class. And really, this class is about a Christian approach to reading the great books. That's what the humanities courses are here at CCA. We are reading through the great books and talking about them and getting a understanding the Christian approach to reading all of these great books that have shaped Western civilization. And there's always going to be a lens for which you read or ingest everything in your life. There are always presuppositions and axioms through which you take everything in and interpret them. And the same is true with reading anything, including the great books. And studying the great books gives one perspective of the past. And C.S. Lewis says in God and the Dock, he says, "The only palliative is to keep the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds. And this can be done only by reading old books." That's C.S. Lewis in the God and the Dock. And what Lewis means by this is that we find that when we read the great books of the past, we see that people thought very differently about some very fundamental things, assumptions that modern people share, no matter how widely they think they disagree, turn out not to be shared at all by people of the ancient world, especially in some really fundamental issues, issues like the questions involving the nature of the universe. What is the nature of the universe? Why is man here? What is his chief end? What is the purpose of life? How do we find wisdom? Who is God? What is love? What is the relationship between the individual and the state? What is the relationship between men and women? What is the relationship between adults and children? All of these questions are questions that reading the great books turns up answers to. But the answers from these old authors are often very different from the answers that we often have. So what Lewis means when he talks about the clean sea breeze of the century blowing through our mind is that we are enabled, there are possibilities there to get a different perspective on ideas and questions that we have never thought about before. And since we all share similar assumptions here in modernity, no matter how radically we might disagree about some things, to find someone else who actually differs on those different assumptions is actually very helpful to us. Someone from the past, someone who is breathing entirely different air than we are, and it enables us folks that are stuck in modernity in our time and place right now to unload some of that mental baggage that otherwise we would never question. And perspective is really important. In reading the great books, for the purpose of understanding what made our culture, what makes us who we are, what makes Western civilization, is really important. And despite the fact that our culture over the last century has been rejecting and ignoring history, our culture is still deeply indebted to the ideas of the past. And to read these great books of the past, to read Eusebius's accounts of the early church in the first few centuries, or to read Augustine's Confessions, Martin Luther's Bondage of the Will, those books shaped the people who shaped our culture. And not to know them is not to know why our culture is the way that it is. So a Christian approach doesn't reject all those ideas, but a Christian approach to the great books differs in this respect. Many modern followers of the great books idea have a syncretistic approach to the discovery of truth. Now, you may be asking, well, this is a big word. What is syncretism? Well, syncretism is the dictionary. This is New Oxford definition of syncretism. It says syncretism is the attempted reconciliation or union of different or opposing principles, practices, or parties, as in philosophy or religion. So basically, what this definition means is that basically it's saying that truth comes from a variety of sources. And as regarding the great books, if we stand and listen to what is called the great conversation, which I'll put that in quotes, the conversation carried on over time by Aristotle and Augustine and Aquinas and Calvin and Milton, these sorts of folks, if we listen to this conversation in the books that they wrote of all these different voices, then we come, you know, says this approach, to truth. But a Christian can't say that. A Christian can't say that at all. Now, a Christian certainly agrees that we can find out valuable things from reading great books, but a Christian finds the place of truth, the foundation of truth, the locus of truth from divine revelation and through the revelation of the Bible and through God's incarnate Son, Jesus Christ. That's where we find truth. So reading the great books can certainly be valuable to us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be spending all this time reading it and having the great books, reading great books as a part of our logic students' education. It can be valuable. We don't deny that. But at the same time, we don't put an inordinate amount of value on it, because it, when rubber meets the road, it's not the source of truth. So the Christian approach to the great books is that we can find truth through the revelation of God, through creation and the scriptures, and with the revelation or lenses that we've been given by God to interpret the world, we can read the great books determining what is true and what is false. And we can call the Christian approach to the great books a confessional approach. We confess the truth of Christian revelation, and then with that as the lens we can see through, we can see what's important in the great books, and we can see what's valuable in the great books, and we can also see what's not very valuable. And otherwise, you know, we are left to some other lens that see through, and no good can come from that. That's what's going on in the modern world today with the rejection of the Bible as the source of truth. We can see the breakdown of all kinds of understandings of standards and absolutes, and that certainly applies to education in non-Christian families and government schools, including this also includes what we think the great books are, or whether there even are great books out there. You know, one way that you can see this is with Mortimer Adler's set of great books. Mortimer Adler lived in the early 20th century, and he put together this set. I think the Britannica put his set together of what he thought the great books are. And it's very interesting. If you look through the great books, you'll see all of the folks that you normally would see: Aristotle, Plato. You would see even the first church fathers, all the way up to Augustine. And then it's interesting though, but between Augustine, there's the Augustine volume with all of Augustine's works, and then the next book in the set is Thomas Aquinas. Now, when did Augustine live? Augustine lived in the 300 ADs and 400 ADs. And then when did Thomas Aquinas live? Well, Thomas Aquinas lived in 800 years later. So there's a gap between 400 AD and what is that, 800? That's and 1200 AD, right? That's 800 years. 800 years of what you would think, if that was the only set of great books you saw, of silence. There's a huge gap there. And most people won't think about that gap. But a Christian will. An informed Christian will. And the reason that gap is there is because the idea of what the great books are influenced by an inheritance that we have from the Enlightenment of the 1700s. Now, in that era, all sorts of theologians and philosophers and some Christians started rejecting that the source of truth comes from divine revelation, and that is, and that it is from reason that we can find truth. And then, so we have the rise of deism after that. Now, what is deism? Well, deism is the belief in the existence of a supreme being, specifically of a creator who does not intervene in the universe. As according to the New Oxford Dictionary, this term is used chiefly of an intellectual movement of the 17th and 18th centuries that accepted the existence of a creator on the basis of reason, but rejected belief in a supernatural deity who interacts with humankind. Basically, this is the idea of God as the great watchmaker. He would wind up the universe, set it ticking, and then once it got going, he sat back down, and now it operates on its own, on physical principles, with no intervention from God, basically eliminating the idea of the supernatural or the miraculous. Now, deism was one major aspect of Enlightenment thinking. But Enlightenment thinking in general rejected the idea that Christian revelation is the foundation or the ground for truth. So inversely, any age that's deeply saturated with Christian faith, according to the Enlightenment thinker, must automatically be viewed as a superstitious age. And that's exactly what these Enlightenment thinkers thought that the Middle Ages were. But as we'll find out, if you're a Christian, these were our people. These were our folks. The ground that we're covering in Humanities 2 is the Church Fathers through the Reformation. This is essentially the age of Christendom. This is the age that we'll chiefly be studying this year, the age of Christianity. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that every single person was a Christian. You know, there was a lot of evil and corruption and wickedness, a lot of that. But the idea that the Middle Ages were an age of superstition and dark ages is just simply not true. The Middle Ages were not the dark ages, as in modern Enlightenment thinkers would have you to think. You know, and these Enlightenment thinkers, they look back at this age that was dominated by the Christian faith and said that it was a dark age because it's dominated by a Christian faith. And, you know, that's what they said, and our modern world has inherited that attitude from them. And so without even thinking about it, we think of all the Middle Ages as a dark age. Now, there was a period of darkness shortly after the collapse of the Roman Empire, around 500 AD, running up to maybe 800 AD, but by then we have Charlemagne and we have the Frankish Kingdom and King Alfred the Great in England, both making great efforts to revive culture. And by the year 1000 or 1100, education is revived in a huge way, and universities have started schools, and universities and schools are going, liberal arts schools are going. Liberal arts is flourishing, architecture is flourishing, all of these things are flourishing. And by the time you get to the High Middle Ages, around 1300, we have Gothic architecture, we have Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, and we have Dante's Divine Comedy. And these are all expressions of the greatest aspects of culture that any human has ever produced in any age. So the Middle Ages were not dark by any means by modern standards. But since that age was ruled by the Christian faith, Enlightenment thinkers think it was dark, and we've inherited that attitude from these 17th and 18th century thinkers. A Christian just can't agree that this age, these Middle Ages, were dark. You know, a Christian ought to look at the Middle Ages and say that those are my people. And we need to say that that time was in many ways an age of light. I think it's more of an age of light than we have today. I think today is, at least in the United States, we're living in a dark age. We can certainly say that as Christians, we can think of a lot of books that Mortimer Adler left out of the set. Many of them, which we will read this year, books that were tremendously influential to Western culture, but by and large ignored by the modern secularist attitude towards what the great books are. So we'll be reading these books this year by authors like the Venerable Bede. The church history, the ecclesiastical history of the English people. Sorry about the background noise. We have some thunder going on outside. We're reading Bede. And who is Bede? Well, Bede was a Saxon monk in northern England who wrote about the early history of England, and all modern historians, whether Christian or secular, look to Bede for their understanding of the early history of England. Another author we'll read is Saint Benedict, who wrote The Rule, which shaped all of monasticism in the Christian Middle Ages, and monasticism right up until today. The monasteries in the Middle Ages were very important in the survival of Christian culture all through the Middle Ages. And the monasteries preserved learning and the ancient languages, and basically the learning that had been inherited from the Greek and Roman ages. They preserved some of those things, and these things that were being lost by the rest of the world. And these monasteries were formed by the rule of Saint Benedict. Another author we'll be reading is Geoffrey of Monmouth. Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing in the 1100s, wrote the first epic about King Arthur, and it has been very influential on the imagination of the English-speaking people everywhere in the world, and it certainly was a huge influence on so many other versions of the King Arthur story. It was also very influential on the Renaissance period and the Reformation cultures. And again, right up until 150 years ago, Geoffrey of Monmouth's book was widely known in Western culture. And it certainly had a place. It certainly has a place in the great books. So the inheritance that we have had from the Enlightenment that says that anything produced in a time that was dominated by Christianity can't be of value, that inheritance has really caused a tremendous loss to us. So in this course, we are going to read a number of stories and histories and theologies and philosophical works that were produced in the Middle Ages, because this is a Christian approach, the true approach to the great books. The general nature of the course, there'll be plenty of discussion. There'll be reading, lots of reading. We'll be reading close to 20 books, 20 to 30 books this year. I'll make sure that we'll be comprehending what we're reading. There'll be projects, there'll be activities, and there'll be tests and quizzes as well. And of course, there'll be reading assignments every night, and there'll be some studying and small writing assignments in class and at home. So this is a quick overview to the Humanities 2 class. This is just a sample of some of the classes that our students receive. This is just a sample of the education our students receive at Christ Church Academy. So if you're interested in checking out what we're more of what we're all about, what our mission is, what the purpose of education is, if you're just looking to enroll your student sometime in the next school year, these are the types of things at least your junior high age student will encounter. They'll be going through Humanities 2. with me. We'll be reading the church fathers through the Reformation. We'll be studying that time period. We also have Humanities 1 that talks about the ancient, pre-Greek, pre-biblical time, or biblical times, all the way up until the time of Christ, and so on and so forth. We have logic. We teach Latin and Greek. So if you're interested in finding out what we're about, please visit us at ChristChurchAcademy.org. Please email us there, and someone will be able to contact you, and we can arrange a tour and get to know one another. Once again, thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon.